Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell and CFRC's Arts Coordinator Genevieve Hinch. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Era McCauley, covering an update on the proposed Alto High-Speed Rail line.
Hello, I'm Era McCauley, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today on YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m., or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach out to our news team at news@cfrc.ca. On June 22nd, Alto President and CEO Martin Imbleau released the What We Heard report alongside Stephen McKinnon, Minister of Transport and the leader of the government in the House of Commons. The report, which was published online and delivered at a press conference in Kingston, took into account public feedback gathered during the first phase of Alto High-Speed Rail's consultation process, including conversations with Indigenous communities along the Toronto-Quebec City corridor and concerns from agricultural producers, landowners, and rural communities related to impacts on and access to rural property.
Over 100 days between January and April, we conducted consultations to deepen our understanding of the corridor. We made a deliberate decision to engage early and before key decisions were made. That means that we did not have all the answers. We wanted to meet people and to listen first. We did not want to show up with a predetermined alignment. It could have been faster, but it would not have been appropriate for what comes next. 10,000 people attended the open houses, minister said it, 300,000 people online, that is historical. We also conducted meetings with the Indigenous communities. We had meetings with 30 of the communities, and what we did was a critical step. And throughout the first consultation period, a few key themes arised consistently. Of course, land acquisition, protection of agricultural land, environmental impacts, quality of life, and these concerns will directly inform the next phase of our planning. Agricultural land was our major focus. At the end of April, very recently, we put our commitment on paper. First, we want to minimize the impact. We want to prioritize the agreements from a willing seller, willing buyer with the farmers, provide a fair compensation, and ensure access will be maintained while supporting long-term productivity of the farmers.
Minister McKinnon had this to say.
We have heard how popular this project is, but also about important considerations, and yes, concerns that many Canadians have. And I want to acknowledge those concerns. I want to acknowledge those fears. I want to say to those who are in the agricultural sector, those who own land, we understand. I come from a farming family myself. We understand how attached people are to their farms, to their land, to their heritage, to their legacy. And I have directed Alto to proceed with extreme sensitivity, to respectfully deal with landowners who will end up along this route, this 60 meter wide corridor that has to, in most cases, travel in a straight line, because high speed rail does not like curves. But we will proceed with the least possible impact on people's properties, with the least possible and least intrusive impact possible on our natural environment, and Canadians want us to do that as well. We will not cut corners when it comes to respect. We will not cut corners when it comes to sensitivity.
Following a review of the report, Minister McKinnon directed Aalto to develop a plan to assess a southern route option between Peterborough and Ottawa that included a potential stop in Kingston with via rail service integration.
But one of the other things that has become very clear to us, hence our presence here today, is how strongly the people of Kingston and this area feel about being included. And today, I'm pleased to be able to say, we heard you. We also heard from those in Cornwall, in Gananoque, Napanee, in Belleville, Trenton, Cobourg, Port Hope, and yes, even Oshawa, who also want to be connected to this incredible network. So we are formally asking Aalto to develop a plan to assess a southern route option between Peterborough and Ottawa that includes a stop in Kingston that would interconnect, yes, interconnect with via rail services, subject to technical feasibility and project requirement.
The plea for Kingston was consistent, strategic, well-organized, and definitely preliminary analysis showed that a stop in Kingston could have a positive impact on ridership. And as the minister said it, a big portion of the population would be within 20, 25 minutes of a train station, which will be transformational.
Mayor Patterson was on hand to share his enthusiasm for the project as well.
We, of course, are very encouraged and excited by the potential to have a high-speed rail stop here in Kingston, and very excited by the potential to be able to have a hub that would link in with via rail, being able to connect this entire region, the province and beyond, with both conventional and high-speed rail. There's been a lot of conversation about high-speed rail, obviously, in our community and across the region over the last number of months. And I think of particularly one comment that a resident shared with me, that he'd done the numbers and he said, you know, that on a per capita basis, the Kingston is probably the most successful rail-oriented community in the entire country. And I think it's very fitting and exciting that Kingston can, and I think very much should play a role in the future of what that rail infrastructure should look like. Whatever is going to be built to improve rail infrastructure, we want to be a part of it and we want to help support it. As has already been said, we have so many national and regional institutions here in Kingston, Queen's University, Royal Military College, St. Lawrence College, we have Kingston Health Sciences Center, we have CFB Kingston, and of course a diverse and growing private sector as well. And so it's never been more important for our community for people to be able to get to and from here and across the region, and we think that this is a really positive and encouraging step forward on that front.
Kingston City Council has since signed a non-disclosure agreement, NDA, with Aalto as part of the development of the high-speed rail line through the region, which has sparked concerns with the Aalto HSR Citizen Research Initiative, who had petitioned the city not to sign the agreement and is now saying, quote, "The objection is not that confidential material was shared confidentially. It is that information was withheld until silence was promised, that access to the facts was made conditional on a commitment not to use them. It is now on the city's own account, a description of Kingston." A city spokesperson explained that the NDA applies to all city staff and councillors and was needed for the city to receive any technical information from Aalto. The Citizen Research Initiative rejected this claim, noting that the bargain Kingston accepted, silence in exchange for information, was offered on the premise that there was no alternative. Two neighboring counties declined it, and one of them proceeded to put the promoter's own material on the public record. The alternative existed, and Kingston did not take it, and it is not explained why. The counties referenced are Stormont, Dundas, Glengarry, and United Counties of Prescott and Russell, whose councils turned down the requests in June and May, respectively. Last week, Transport Action Canada, a nonprofit citizen-based organization that promotes sustainable transport and functions as a consumer-based advocacy group, sent a letter to Minister McKinnon and issued a press release outlining their support for the Kingston stop, with some concerns. In their press release, TAC notes that it has had a decades-long history of advocating for high-speed rail in the Quebec-Windsor corridor, including providing input on various proposals that have preceded Aalto. While pleased with the concept in principle, TAC says they are cautious about fully endorsing the project unless the stop in Kingston is closely integrated with the existing via rail station, arguing a stop at the proposed southern alignment, a 25 to 30-minute drive north of Kingston, would significantly harm the high-speed rail's ability to connect effectively with via rail services. According to Aalto, it is expected that the high-speed rail would reduce travel times between Kingston and Toronto to approximately 90 minutes. Current travel times on via rail range from 2 hours and 19 minutes to 2 hours and 45 minutes. Aalto states that inclusion on their HSR route would establish Kingston as a key regional mobility hub, improving connections and placing up to 80% of residents between Peterborough and Ottawa within a 25-minute drive of a station. According to a City Council report that was sent to the Minister to plead Kingston's case for the stop on the route, Kingston is Via Rail's fourth busiest station.
Plus, between St. Lawrence, Queens, and RMC, you have an additional 35,000 students who regularly travel back and forth to other cities. And you're already a hub for regional connectivity, with the fourth busiest Via Rail station in Canada. I was amazed to read that statistic. One that serves as a key anchor in a proven and robust rail culture.
While connections with Via Rail services are considered integral to the high-speed rail's successful integration into the public transport landscape by Transport Action Canada, they flagged Via Rail's poor track record for on-time services, which they argue must be addressed if the government wants to instill confidence in constituents that Aalto can meet its service goals. They call for improvements to the current regulatory and operational framework governing access to Metrolinx, a Government of Ontario agency created to improve the coordination and integration of transportation in the GTA and Hamilton, and CN infrastructure, as well as clear federal leadership to address persistent dispatching delays, infrastructure bottlenecks, and access arrangements. It is quite hard, they say, to make a competitive connection when one service can regularly be expected to be 30-plus minutes late. According to a quarterly report released by Via Rail in 2025, on-time performance fell sharply from 72% in Q1 2024 to just 30% in the first quarter of 2025, something they blamed on what they called arbitrary operational restrictions imposed by CN Rail in the Quebec City to Windsor corridor, leading to longer travel times and reduced service reliability. Transport Action Canada says it remains optimistic and broadly supportive of the project and hopes that, much like in the case of a Kingston stop, the government remains open to constructive input to deliver a much-needed service to Canadians.
We do not approach this work with anything other than a lot of respect for the work that needs to get done, for overcoming the doubts that people may have, but also to continue building the great excitement that Canada can be a home for high-speed rail, something we arguably should have done decades ago. But we are beginning in earnest today.
Thank you, Era. Coming up next, we have Dinah Jansen reading a story from the local journalism initiative reporter for YGK News, Sarah Beavis, that covers the influx of funding to build a school in Westbrook.
Thank you, Jesse. The City of Kingston announced Friday that the Limestone District School Board will build a new elementary school in Westbrook to help meet growing demand driven by residential development and urban expansion. The project is part of a $1.6 billion provincial investment supporting 79 school projects across Ontario. LDSB has received $21.4 million in provincial funding to build a school that will accommodate over 400 students. In September 2025, Kingston City Council submitted an application to the Ministry of Education for a new school building in the Westbrook neighborhood. Limestone District School Board Chief Executive Officer and Director of Education Krishna Burra gave a statement to YGK News about the importance of a new elementary school in Westbrook. According to a report presented to City Council by Watson and Associates economists in 2024, Kingston West will see the most population growth in the next 25 years of any neighborhood in the city. Loyalist Cataraqui Councillor Paul Chaves, whose district includes Westbrook, explained the growing demand for schools in the area. Councillor Chaves also described the condition of the current school in Westbrook, W.J. Holsgrove Public School, and the need for a new elementary school. Holsgrove School is busting at the seams in regard to the number of students they have, said Councillor Chaves. The City of Kingston is proposing a land exchange in which the new school will be built in the Westbrook Park, and the site of W.J. Holsgrove Public School would become a new park. MPP of Kingston and the Islands Ted Hsu hopes the new school can keep up with the growing demand in the Kingston's northwest area. Hsu believes that the recently constructed Catholic school in the West End neighborhood of Woodhaven, St. Genevieve, is already at capacity and continues to grow. grow. While further details and construction timelines have yet to be announced, the City of Kingston and the Limestone District School Board will host an information session for community members in the fall.
Thank you to Dinah Jansen and Sarah Beavis for that story. Coming up next, we have a story from the LJI reporter for CJAI Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, about the suspension of Greater Napanee's grass-cutting program.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Greater Napanee Council has unanimously decided to suspend a grass-cutting order until staff can review the bylaw and bring back more information. Staff will be looking to differentiate between neglected lawns and naturalized lawns in the bylaw. Mayor Terry Richardson explained the process will likely involve public consultation.
We at the Town of Greater Napanee have recognized that the bylaw that we have should be updated. We have updated a vast amount of bylaws, a vast amount of processes and policies over the past 2.5 years. The lawn cutting bylaw is one that we do need to address. We do need to update it. And we've just run out of time. And it's going to require, I think, probably an awful lot of public consultation, because for every conversation that we have, there's someone on the other side of the conversation that says, well, what about this and what about that? So I know it's one of those things that's high on the priority list. So rest assured, we will look at it. It's an issue that the municipality has recognized. It's just a timing thing.
Richardson spoke about concerns regarding lawn grass.
It's very well known that the black-legged tick in eastern Ontario, specifically in long areas of Lake Ontario, they're very, very prominent, and probably a good portion of those ticks do carry the Lyme disease. Most recently in the news, we've heard about the Lone Star tick. I guess the concern with the long grass is the first of all, for me anyways, is the tick problem, because of the prominent tick problem that we have in eastern Ontario. It should be a concern.
CAO Matthew Grant spoke about the work staff would be doing in the meantime.
I think staff can come back and talk about what a review process would look like. I think that this would require reasonable amounts of public consultation. One of the number one complaints we get in bylaw services is unkept lawns. So we could take a look at the experience of others. We could provide options at that time. Because, of course, whatever we would recommend would be something that would be extrapolated out to the broader community. So 1 month's time to be able to put that together, I think, is a reasonable ask. And until such time, I'm happy to tell bylaw to suspend the order.
Residents came forward to ask council to suspend the grass cutting order while they update their bylaw. Resident Austin Lloyd spoke about issues with the current bylaw.
I believe Greater Napanee's grass-cutting bylaw served our community well when it was written 25 years ago, but horticulture and environmental science has changed, and I believe our bylaw should change too. I want to be clear, I'm not suggesting that people should be allowed to abandon their properties. Public safety, neighborhood appearance, and respect for neighbors matters. Vegetation should never block sidewalks, roads, intersections, traffic signs, hydrants, or spill into neighboring properties. Naturalized landscapes should still have maintained edges, clear pathways, and appropriate setbacks. There is an important difference between neglected property and an intentionally managed landscape. Right now, I don't think our bylaw clearly recognizes that difference.
Lloyd noted more modernized bylaws that other communities across Ontario are adopting.
Burlington recognizes naturalized landscapes that are deliberately planted, regulated, and regularly maintained. Belleville also allows naturalized gardens while continuing to require proper maintenance, setbacks, and removal of noxious weeds. These communities haven't lowered their standards, They've modernized them.
Resident Julie Bogdanowitz tends to two properties on Dorland Drive and received an order to comply with grass cutting. Bogdanowitz invited council to view her properties, and councilors who did noted the importance of naturalized lawns and removing noxious weeds. Bogdanowitz explained what a new bylaw could focus on.
Many municipalities in Ontario have modernized and fine-tuned their bylaws. And so instead of a bylaw requiring the removal of tall grass, a bylaw can speak to the health and safety and the removal of noxious plants. And I know firsthand how cities can evolve and modernize their bylaws to be more specific about health, safety, and sustainability.
Councillor Bob Norrie spoke about viewing Bogdanowitz's properties and updating the bylaw.
My wife and I Sunday drove out here. The noxious weeds are gone, which being on Quinte Conservation, I've learned a lot about. It doesn't have to be a pristine garden of flowers. This was quite something to see. So I really think we have to rethink this, because maybe people with backyards like where I live near the hospital might want to have it looking like that. You know, make it more for the butterflies than that.
Councillor Bill Martin spoke about what the new bylaw might look like.
That's what we really want to get to, is noxious weeds, not whether somebody's got a naturalized lawn. So, I mean, I really think we need to amend our bylaw to accept the fact that one size doesn't always fit all. The order to mow, I think, should be suspended until staff can look at the bylaw. And I think there should be an appeal process put in there if somebody gets an order to do whatever, whether it's mowing or whatever, there should be an appeal process.
Richardson spoke about bylaw enforcement in the meantime.
Bylaw enforcement is an extremely difficult job to do at times. So I know that they're trying to use, or I think that they've tried to use some form of discretion in order to find some type of resolution so that we can at least keep peace in the neighborhood, I guess is the best way to put it.
Staff will be coming forward with more information for council at their next meeting, August 28th. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Now over to Genevieve Hinch with a story from Keith Dempsey, LJR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, about first quarter gaming revenue payments in Gananoque and the Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands.
Thank you, Dinah. The Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation, OLG, has issued first quarter gaming revenue and payments of $221,901. Each of the town of Gananoque and the township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands for hosting Shoreline Casino's Thousand Island. The payments will cover the period from April 1st to June 30th, the first quarter of the fiscal year, and represent an increase from the $185,356 each municipality received from the previous quarter of Jan 1st to March 31st. Since what is now known as Shoreline's Casino's Thousand Islands opened in June 2002, Gananoque and the TLTI have each received $34,681,993 through OLG's Municipal Revenue Sharing Program, officials at the agency said. The stronger first quarter payment follows a year in which annual gaming revenue continues its long-term decline. During OLG's 2025 to 2026 fiscal year, each municipality received $873,544, down from the approximately $938,000 the previous fiscal year. While the latest quarterly payment signals an improvement from the previous quarter, annual casino revenues remain well below historical highs. In the early 2010s, Gananoque and the TLTI each received more than $1.8 million annually, more than double the amount received in 2025 to 26. Municipal officials have previously acknowledged casino revenues are unlikely to return to those peak levels and emphasized the importance of diversifying municipal revenue sources rather than relying heavily on gaming payments. Gaming hosting payments are calculated using a province-wide generated formula based on gaming revenue at each site. According to OLG, host communities across Ontario have received more than $2.4 billion in non-tax gaming revenue since 1994. The corporation said all of its profits are reinvested in the province, with municipal hosting payments supporting local infrastructure, community services, and economic development.
Thank you to Genevieve Hinch and Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with the Kingston Sports Report, brought to you by CFRC Power Plays.
This is part three of your OUA football season preview brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. Today we're looking at the ninth place team from 2025, the Waterloo Warriors. A team touched by tragedy, the Waterloo Warriors showed a great deal of will and skill in 2025. A scrappy unit with some outstanding athletes in all three phases, the Warriors showed flashes of brilliance last year in narrow losses to Ottawa and Carleton. They upended the Varsity Blues on a last-second field goal to tally their first win of the season, before turning in a respectable effort in the Battle of Waterloo against Laurier. They faced Queens in their homecoming game, and that's when everything changed for the program. Late in the second quarter, starting quarterback Nick Orr was knocked out of the game by a hit from Justin Pace. This hit, which resulted in a lengthy suspension for Pace, had immense consequences for Orr, who may never play football again. The Warriors would rally around their injured quarterback and score one final win against the York Lions to finish 2-6 on the year. Honestly, pretty remarkable given the circumstances. Let's take a look at their 2025 stats. They did finish 11th in the conference in points for with 137, that's about 17 points per game. They were 10th in yards per game with 359 and finished with 2,720 yards, also 10th in the conference. They were 8th in total pass yards with 1,901, and they were 6th in total rush yards with 969, about 121 per game. Not too bad. Now defensively, they did finish 9th in points allowed with 283, but this is a defense that is better than the stats would indicate. They were actually 4th in passing yards allowed per game with 263, and 9th in rush yards allowed per game with 168.8. They finished 6th, so right in the middle, in total yards allowed per game, but once again, I think this defense is better than the numbers indicate. In terms of point differential, they were last in the conference with a minus 146, largely because their offense, which once again dealt with some pretty major injuries, just couldn't string together consistent scoring drives, but I don't think that's indicative of where this team actually was. Over the last five seasons, in 2021, they had a 3-3 record, the final year of quarterback Trey Ford. In 2022, 1-7. 2023, bounce back year, finishing 3-5. 2024, 0-8, although I will say they were one of the better 0-8 teams I ever watched. And in 2025, they finished 2-6. So, a lot of up, a lot of down, but I do think the program is trending in the right direction. Looking ahead to 2026, well, there are a lot of departures for the Warriors. Running back Quinton Springer, who I thought was one of the better players on offense, period, for them, has transferred to their crosstown rivals at Laurier. Wide receiver Romel Samuel Slocum is gone. Running back Anthony Miller, a long-standing Warrior, is gone. Backup quarterback Nolan Caban is done. Nick Orr, as we touched on, is likely out for the season. Thankfully, Waterloo does have a new generation ready to step up on offense, including quarterback Emmett Ward and running back Roy Vanderveen, who was an unquestioned bright spot for the Warriors last season. They also have the outstanding linebacker Michael Omoseni back, and I love watching Omoseni play. He is so fast, so instinctive, just a fantastic defensive player. The Warriors do have a tough 2026 schedule ahead of them. They play the Ottawa teams back-to-back before traveling to Kingston for what will surely be an emotionally charged rematch with the Gales. That's Queen's home opener. The Warriors have tough games against Laurier in the Battle of Waterloo, Windsor, and Guelph before closing things out with McMaster and York. And I do think Waterloo could beat McMaster, but I am going to give the Marauders the benefit of the doubt this year. I've got Waterloo going 1-7, but finishing in 9th ahead of York and Toronto.
And thank you to Jesse Bell for that update, and also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Tuesday, August 4th. 27 is your high, feeling a degree warmer with a UV index of 8, mostly sunny with a few clouds here and there. Wednesday, August 5th, 25 is your high with cloudy and humid conditions feeling closer to 30 degrees. Thursday, August 6th, 27 is your high, but with the humidity it feels closer to 30, and once again we've got a UV index of 8. Friday, August 7th. 26 degrees is your high with largely sunny conditions, feeling closer to 27, so a little cooler. Beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. Saturday, August 8th, 25 is your high with a 55% chance of precipitation in the morning, going to feel closer to 30 degrees otherwise and quite humid. Sunday, August 9th, 25 is your high, feeling closer to 30, partly sunny, with a 70% chance of afternoon thunderstorms. And starting off next week, Monday, August 10th, 25 is your high with a 55% chance of precipitation.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.